Good morning, Connecticut. To our friends across the sound, it's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, we've got a busy show this morning. First, we're going to check in with a representative from the upcoming Westport Makers Fair, a gathering place for creatives, inventors, and anyone interested in the makers movement. Then we'll welcome Operation Fuel CEO Pat Rice and review a number of her achievements as she heads into retirement later this year. Then we're going to speak with a representative from WCHN, the Western Connecticut Health Network, about how mergers among several state hospitals and providers are creating a new, responsive, and even more robust network of healthcare support. And we'll wrap replaying part of a 2015 chat about Call Before You Dig. April is Call Before You Dig month, and we're going to remind you about why CBYD is such an important initiative in April and all year round. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. You know, these days, everybody knows somebody with Lyme disease, which is a good reason to head out for the Lyme Walk and Run next Sunday, April 24th at Cove Island Park in Stamford. The event's going to include a certified 5K run as well as a 1 mile and 3 mile walk. On-site registration fees are $35 per person and $90 per family. Check-in is at 9 a.m. and the main event starts at 10. The Global Lyme Alliance raises funds to support research, education, and awareness of Lyme and tick-borne diseases, and funds raised from this event are going towards GLA's mission. For more information, to volunteer, fundraise, or just to register, visit limewalkrun.org. Well, as regular listeners know, the scope of our program and the guests we welcome ranges from folks like we heard from a week or two ago with Governor Malloy and Congresswoman Esty, all the way down to individuals who initiate grassroots programs and events and activities that really, as grassroots do, catch the imagination and spirit of folks. And there is one coming up that you really need to hear about. We're so pleased to welcome a new friend to the award-winning For the People. Mark Mathias is on the line with us. He is founder and co-chair of the Westport Mini Maker Fair. This is the fifth annual event, and it's coming to Westport on Saturday, April 30th at the Westport Library and Jessup Green. And as I was briefly chatting with Mark ahead of turning on the microphone, I was actually shocked to learn why they need to have so much space for this event, because they're actually thinking they're going to draw an excess of 10,000 people in this fifth year. So, Mark, congratulations. And man, what a great activity.
Well, John, thank you very much. Yeah, it's been a very pleasant surprise to see how well this has been received by the community around us here in Fairfield County, Connecticut.
And I guess it really speaks to the amazing things that people from, you know, even as young as maybe 4, 5, 6 years old, all the way up to our seniors and everybody in between, all the fun and, as you pointed out, the education that they're getting from designing things that will come out of a 3D printer, right?
Well, yeah, it's actually even broader than that. It's but you're right. We cover all age groups. We have events for children as young as a couple months old, all the way up to people in their 80s and 90s. It really goes back to this whole idea there's an inherent desire for people, we as humans, to make things. We make things out of 3D printers, as you indicated. We make music. We make art. We make all sorts of crafts. We make robots. We make things out of wood. And we really support and love to have people that make all sorts of things, which is one of the reasons, to your point, which is why we've attracted such a large crowd over the years, is because we really, it's quite literally a big tent, and we welcome everyone who has creativity, innovation, a desire to learn, a desire to have fun, and sometimes a desire to be a little bit crazy as well.
So let's go back to before year one now. That was back in, around 2010. How did this whole thing get started?
Well, you may have heard of the what's called the maker movement, and there are these maker fairs that happen. They've been going on for a little over 10 years now. And I ended up taking my two children to the World Maker Fair in New York. It's typically in the fall. And I took them there. They were like 5 and 7 or something, or 5 and 12 at the time, and just had no idea really what to expect. And we wandered around, and my kids, they're good kids, but they just got engaged with all the things that there were to see. And they had so much fun, and they really had no idea they were learning. And I said, this is something we have to bring to Connecticut. This is just too valuable to have it be in New York. There are a lot of people, for whatever reason, here in Connecticut that either don't know about it or can't get to New York. And so I got the idea of bringing Maker Faire to Connecticut. And so I did. And go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, what are some of the fantastic things that you've seen from attendees and participants in past years?
In past years, we've had, in fact, one that's a very popular one, and we're actually continuing a similar thing. We have a guy here in Fairfield County who made a personal submarine, and he brought it to the fair. And it's about 8 feet long and fits one person, and you get to get kids and adults to get inside this submarine and ask him how he built it and how he made it and what he did. This year, for example, we have a dragon that we're building that's going to be, probably 10, 12 feet tall and 15 feet long.
Wow.
And we're building actually in our Westport Library. It's a community build, and people will get to see this this dragon that's going to be built here in our community. We're actually, to go back to the submarine theme, we actually have the people from Electric Boat Company that are coming down. They're the ones that build submarines for the
sure.
military.
The big ones.
They're coming. Exactly. They're not going to bring a submarine down, but they're going to talk about submarine technology. We have people from Sikorsky coming talking about helicopters. We have a woman who in the past has done art with a paintball gun. So you don't think of a paintball gun as typically an artist tool, but we're having somebody who's bringing a paintball gun. This year we're having a woman come back who makes violins, and many people have played a violin or a bass or a cello or something like that. But this woman actually makes them, and she shows you how people make musical instruments. It's things like that that really, you don't have to be a technology person. You don't have to be necessarily an artist. You have to be kind of a person that's interested in seeing things that you've probably never seen before, and that's what Maker Faires are. You get to come and see these things. You get to talk to the person or people who made this, and they tell you about their passions, why they got the idea to do it, and it's fascinating for everyone to come by and see it.
Man, inspiring. I guess it really sets people on fire. Like it's one thing to like see a video or see it on TV or even see it, in a static display. But when you're there with the person and you feel that passion, I mean, as I mentioned before, we had Congresswoman Esty on the program a week or two ago, and she had just come from a maker's classroom where the kids manufactured key rings in the shape of the 5th district that she represents here in Connecticut. And it's just fascinating when you get fired up talking to the people who are the actual creators.
Indeed you do, John. In fact, that's one of the things that I find so fascinating about this is that unlike seeing things in a magazine and newspaper on the internet, we are, when it really comes down to it, we're humans. And when you have an opportunity to meet someone who has done something that you think is inspiring, and you have a chance to talk to them one-on-one about how did you make this? How did you make this robot? How did you make this piece of art? How did you grow this food? How do you get honey out of trees or out of beehives? How do you do that? And they answer your questions. You make that human connection. And we see time and time again people of all ages that get inspired to do something as a result of a Maker Faire. And I'll tell you one thing, John, that happens every year, and I love it. we have a lot of students, a lot of K through 12. We even have a lot of colleges and universities coming to the Maker Faire this year. And I love it where every year somebody who's wandering around, usually a student, says, next year I want to have a booth at the Maker Faire and show off my hobby. Because many of these people have hobbies that maybe they're not mainstream things. Maybe they're kind of things that they like, but they're not, you know, really welcomed by their friends for whatever reason. This gives them an opportunity to be proud of what they're doing, to showcase what they're doing, and get the affirmation of their peers by saying, you know, you can do something just because you have a passion for it, and you can showcase it, and people will appreciate that.
Yeah.
And they'll understand it.
And I imagine this is a place where friendships bloom, and occasionally, perhaps, viable partnerships and networking happens. Maybe there's a situation where somebody connects. You get one person who's looking to market or grow some sort of an invention, and they meet the person with that very special, unique invention that they want to back or they want to support.
You know, John, you're right. That is something else that has really surprised us, is these maker fairs have become an economic driver for the community. To your point, a lot of companies are here that are showcasing new products, new inventions, and almost by serendipity, someone shows up that is either a supplier, a distributor, an investor, a customer, and they see emerging technologies or new products. And it surprises me how many companies we've helped get off the ground or make a connection to an investor or a marketer or whoever it is, and we've helped companies grow because they're growing businesses. And this has become a surprising economic driver for the area. That was completely unexpected, but we're very pleased, obviously, with the results and the fact that it's happening.
Fantastic. Well, before we invite people and give them all the specific details, there's just one other thing I wanted to touch base with you on, and that is, as I'm reading the solicitation for this, I'm seeing, you know, you come to listen and learn and connect. There's going to be food and beverages, but then there's also something in there about hacking. I hope that's not because of the food and beverages.
No. In fact, all of the food providers have to have health certificates from our local health district. So I think they're in good shape with the food.
So this event is actually going to host hackers, computer hackers?
Hacking has a kind of a complex definition. Hacking is really trying to make something that the manufacturer didn't intend it to be.
The unintended consequence of that becomes serendipitous.
Exactly. The idea of somebody made something, but by hacking something, you can make it into something that it wasn't intended to be. No, we're not going to be breaking into big computers or anything like that, but we are going to show a lot of creativity if somebody says, I got this from the store, and look what I've hacked it into.
I see.
And they've made it into something that it wasn't intended, and that's a lot of fun to see that creativity as well.
Fantastic. Well, in the last couple minutes we have with you, Mark, give folks the details and invite them over.
Great. Yeah, the event's going to be Saturday, April 30th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Westport Library and Jessup Green in downtown Westport. Our opening ceremony is going to be at 9:45 in the morning. This is actually a free event to attend, so we hope people will bring their families and friends and creative minds and have a great day and enjoy a day here in downtown Westport.
Fantastic. Well, Mark, I'm glad I made your acquaintance, and I can't wait to talk to you again to find out what's in store for the 6th annual Westport Mini Makers Fair. We'll have to make this an annual visit, if not more frequent, and we appreciate partnering with you and your partnership with us, and we hope folks all over the state come on out for the 5th annual Westport Mini Makers Fair on April 30th. Great to meet you, and thanks so much for your enthusiasm and input. Well, as we mentioned in our introduction, we are unfortunately going to be saying goodbye to a voice and a friend of mine and a friend of the award-winning For the People, certainly a friend to tens of thousands of people in Connecticut who have benefited from Operation Fuel's support over the many years since the agency has been in existence. Much of that time, it's been under the leadership of Patricia Rice. Pat Rice has announced her retirement in the coming months or maybe weeks. We'll find out. And she is on the line with us right now from Hartford. Pat, welcome to the program. Sadly, for the last time, I guess, in your official capacity, although we're always happy to have you. Congratulations, I guess. Bittersweet times, but I guess time to move on, huh?
Yes, it is. And you almost made me cry with that wonderful introduction.
Oh, come on now.
I pinch myself every day for having had the pleasure of working for this wonderful organization with a wonderful mission.
Well,
so I've never viewed it as work, but thank you.
Yeah, sometimes
so much.
Sometimes when I think about all the children and the seniors and the disabled people that would have gone through the winter cold, or some of the sick people that really, really depend on air conditioning in the summer, that got assistance through Operation Fuel, and now year round. It's heartening to know that someone was at the helm that really related to almost each and every single person that ever called or got referred to Operation Fuel for assistance. So let's look back at 18 years. During that time, I guess, getting right to the bottom line, the program started out as just a winter season operation, right?
Yes, and some winters we struggled even to get through the winter. There was such a tremendous need, and we constantly were challenging ourselves to be responsive. And so there were times when we didn't think we were even going to make it through the winter, much less have a program that stayed open all year round.
So what started out as essentially a fund of about $500,000 has now grown under your leadership to distributing more than seven times that amount every year, more than $3.6 million last year. For folks that may not be familiar with the program, let's ask you to do what you do so well and walk folks through what Operation Fuel really is, how it's funded, and how the system works for making an application.
Operation Fuel is a year-round, as you mentioned earlier, statewide program. We actually distribute our assistance through over 100 local organizations throughout the state of Connecticut. And so we were blessed with a mild winter, and if someone today would find themselves in need of assistance, we're still open. And so the easiest way someone can help, who can get help through Operation Fuel, is to call the number 211. And 211 will walk them through, their crisis and tell them that they're a good fit for Operation Fuel and give them a number to call to make an appointment. And it's very simple. It's not an application process that is too hard to grasp. Mm-hmm. We try to help, and we try to make sure that we help people who are in need, and we don't put them through a lot of unnecessary hoops.
Yeah, I guess for a lot
someone's
of
someone's in crisis.
Yeah, it's hard enough to ask for help for a lot of these people, then to drag them through some sort of a bureaucratic process and bury them in paperwork defeats the purpose.
Exactly. I mean, we have a responsibility to those who donate to us. So we want to make sure that it goes to those who are in people who actually need the help. So we do have a small program, application process that, mm-hmm. to verify who someone is and to make sure that they have the bill in their name and verify their income. But other than that, it's really not. And normally we have an answer for them that very same day.
Excellent.
If not a day later. We don't open our program based on the calendar. We really keep our program open based on the need. And today it's been kind of raw, but this past week, when we thought we were through with the winter, we had a surprise. Mother Nature had a surprise. So we stayed open, mm-hmm. to accommodate people who might be needing help. Mm-hmm. And actually, many people did need help. So we were glad that we had the resources to do that.
Yeah, and the other thing that has happened, as we sort of alluded to earlier, is the fact that it started out as a winter program, but now there's assistance available for those who qualify year-round.
Exactly, because we're finding that, you know, when I first started, that, you know, oil prices were very low. They're low now, but they're not as low as when I started. And so people could take care of, they got through the winter, they were fine, they could manage during the off-season. But then as years went on, people were carrying balances from year after year, so they were not managing, they just couldn't keep up through no fault of their own.
Mm-hmm.
And so we realized that there was a need for a summer program, but unfortunately, we, you know, being a small nonprofit, we only had enough dollars and barely enough to get people through the winter. And so we started to focus on how can we be more responsive. And we, you know, we appealed to the general public. We explained what the need is. And I think people responded in like, you know, in kind. And so now we run a program that in the summer that's nearly as big as our winter program.
And you also, a part of the large-scale operations that you're now overseeing in these last, you know, a few weeks of your career with Operation Fuel, the administration has swelled to accommodate and oversee about 100 different fuel banks in the state?
Yes, and they're local organizations. They're not, you know, employees of Operation Fuel.
Right, right.
They have really stepped up, and so they've offered to help Operation Fuel to assist people in their own communities, and so that's been a wonderful asset for us.
Mm-hmm.
We're a staff of 10, and we're statewide, so you know, without those local organizations stepping up, it would be very difficult for people to access, you know, our program. We certainly don't want them driving into Hartford if they're in need.
Sure.
To get in there, you know, to come all the way into Hartford to get help.
Yeah, especially in bad weather. Yep.
Exactly. Well, you know, you know, if someone already is stressed, you don't need to add to that stress.
Yeah.
So we were lucky to have partners throughout the state of Connecticut because we can provide assistance to every single community in the state
mm-hmm.
through our local fuel banks, our local partners.
Yeah. And it's obvious through the fact that the fund has swelled to more than $3.6 million from its humble beginnings of about $500,000 under your leadership is a sign that you're also kind of on that dual path of not only serving and supporting those in need, but being very creative and effective at appealing to the people who have to give to help their neighbors. And Operation Fuel, as you'd always have reiterated on all these visits that we've had together, makes it so easy. And we always say if everybody just went on their utility bill and gave a dollar, nobody would go cold in the winter or hot in the summer who needed it to be cool.
Exactly. And even though that program, we still think there's more potential than what we're realizing in that program, we are seeing a growth in that program. We're now almost over $500,000 just in the Add a Dollar program alone. And since its inception, we've raised through the Add a Dollar program $14 million through people donating on their bills. So that is a tremendous help. And the other is 100% of those dollars actually go for assistance. We don't take any money out for overhead or any other costs.
Mm-hmm. So how is the agency underwritten in terms of expenses?
We raise money separately. You know, most of our grants are the money that we raise are really for energy assistance. And it's really a dual fundraising role that we play. The money we raise for energy assistance, we use that for energy assistance, and then we have to be creative and try to find other ways to support our overhead. And that's why we keep our overhead very lean,
mm-hmm.
because we want our money, 91% of the dollars that we raise actually goes out the door to help people. We're very proud of that record.
Oh, that's a international standards, that's a fantastic return on investment for everyone making a donation, even if it's just a dollar. The other thing we needed to mention before we say farewell for the last time, Pat, is that under your leadership at Operation Fuel, the organization has expanded to now provide a resource for business people.
Yes, and that's something, because these businesses are located in very low-income communities, and you can imagine if those businesses weren't there, that would just add another stressor to those communities. So we were fortunate a few years ago to get $1 million grant from Dominion to start that program. It's called Project Best.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that program's been around for several years now. And it was a new adventure for us, but we realized those bodegas and those laundromats and, you know, those cleaners and those drugstores and those communities are the only services that people have access to for the most part.
So the assistance that your organization can provide to those businesses is really helping to not only sustain those businesses and Connecticut taxpayers, but also improve and sustain health and wellness and in the neighborhoods they serve.
Exactly. It's a quality of life issue. You imagine an elderly person who needs food.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have access to a car. There are very few grocery stores in many of the areas, low-income areas, particularly in the urban centers. You imagine getting on a bus to try to get groceries for a family. So, you know, they're struggling, but they have been there forever through thick and thin, and we want to make sure that they continue. And, you know, if we can help support them, at least with energy and stabilizing their energy costs, then we're also adding value to the communities in which they operate their businesses as well.
And the Project Best also not only is helping sustain the neighborhoods, it's helping sustain the planet, because participants get a credit on their utility bill for completing first-time commercial energy audits, which then tip them off to wasting energy. So it really is an amazing suite of programs between the services you're able to provide to the elderly and disabled and families in need of getting heating or cooling assistance, but now also sustaining businesses in the community and helping them be not only better corporate and commercial neighbors, but also be more energy and environmentally efficient. Just so much great news and such a great legacy to look back on, Pat Rice. We really appreciate your friendship and your partnership through all these years on the award-winning For the People. We're sorry to see you go, but you know where to find us if there's anything we could ever do for you. Best of luck in your retirement after 18 years heading Operation Fuel, Pat, and all the best in your retirement.
Well, thank you so much.
We hope you enjoy it. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Combat Feathers is a nonprofit organization hosting its first annual Bands of Brothers fundraiser to help local veterans in financial need. The fundraiser will include a pasta dinner and the music of four local bands. This fundraiser is going to be held at the Enfield Elks Lodge on Friday, April 29th, starting at 7 p.m. A donation payable at the door of $10 will include a pasta dinner and live music. There'll also be a 50-50 raffle available, as well as other raffle items and a cash bar. All proceeds from the fundraiser will be used to help Connecticut veterans in financial distress. If you'd like more information, just click on combatfeathers.org. All right. Well, you're not going to hear about a new radio station, but we are going to be talking about WCHN. I guess here in Connecticut, it could be a radio station, but I'm talking about the Western Connecticut Health Network. If you haven't heard of it, it is a growing consortium of medical centers and providers here in Western Connecticut, incorporating Danbury, Norwalk, and New Milford hospitals. And today we're going to talk about how the Western Connecticut Health Network and its professionals are reaching out on a new patient engagement campaign. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Andy Keller. He's a longtime practicing cardiologist with internal medicine background. He's the chief medical officer for the Western Connecticut Medical Group, which is the physician arm of Western Connecticut Health Network. And Joe Carafano's on the line. He's VP of Marketing and Communications for WCHN. So, Joe, I want to go to you first, if I may, because you're the marketing guy. The doctors are all, the doctors, the staff, the clinicians, technicians, virtually everybody from top to bottom on this organization are top flight personnel. But you're the one, and your department is the one that's tasked with being able to communicate that out to the greater public that you want to serve in Western Connecticut. Can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you've had as this initiative started with Danbury and New Milford Hospital and has now brought Norwalk Hospital into the picture? I have to imagine that with the availability of social networks, at least it gives you a little bit broader brush to paint all this good news with.
Yeah, I think, a lot has changed over the last several years, not only influencing what happens within our network, but what certainly happens in the healthcare delivery model across the country. I think there's a transformation occurring where we're going from a volume to a value-based model where population health is an important consideration on how we manage members in our communities, and go beyond just treating the sick. Our obligations are to develop a relationship with them to help guide their health care, even in times of wellness. Clearly, from a channel perspective, the other challenge is it's more than radio, respectfully, TV and print. There are new channels available in social media where consumers go and listen and are influenced, and we need to make sure we have a message there that resonates with them, is relevant, and could really help educate and guide their decisions.
So you said the W word, wellness, which is a critical component and something that individuals are looking a lot more toward now. It seems like the industry, as well as the healthcare delivery industry, as well as the insurance industry, is trying to heighten awareness as best it can to the wellness component of lifestyle and health improvement and health management. And I know, having worked with you folks for many, many years in several media capacities, that if there's something that Western Connecticut Health Network does well, it's wellness outreach and education. Can you talk a little bit about, it's kind of like, while at the same time you're promoting this new network and its growing components, you also are sort of, riding the other horse at the same time, the education component.
Right. So I can touch upon this, but I do think Dr. Keller could
add additional
insight.
That was my entree to bring him in too. So let's start from a marketing standpoint in terms of the continuation and enhancement of the community wellness outreach and education.
Yeah, well, I think first we have to understand the evolution of our consumer, and I intentionally did not say patient, because in the wellness model, you're not just speaking to patients or just focused on the sick. It's the ability to identify consumers, to understand their needs, and to bring programs and services to their needs and their family needs within their communities. And therefore, if you look at a lot of hospital or health integrated network advertising, it often is incident-based and promoting sickness. We made a decision to really humanize the healthcare dialogue and to change the dialogue by not promoting sickness and to focus on real-life situations and images that are relatable and desirable and and certainly inspire more wellness than sickness. And that we wanted to make sure that came across in all of our communications, our imageries, and messages also.
Excellent. So how about you, Dr. Andy Keller, also on the line with us. And for folks that may have missed the intro, Dr. Keller is Chief Medical Officer for the Western Connecticut Medical Group, which is the physician arm of the Western Connecticut Health Network, WCHN. So Dr. Keller, what do you think in terms of the outreach and education? What role does that element play overall in how the current consumers for a Western Connecticut Health Network seek out healthcare today?
So, John, first of all, thank you for having me on. It's great
pleasure
to be here with you.
Yep.
I think as Joe alluded to, there's a quantum shift occurring in the United States of how consumers seek out healthcare and get healthcare. And obviously one of them is the introduction of mobile media and consumer-driven healthcare, which is much different than it was even 10 or 15 years ago.
Mm.
But importantly, this brings out a large population of people who are insured, who are in good health, but have not seen a primary care physician and have never really had, even a basic exam, especially in your 50s and 60s, many of these patients, or people actually, have not even seen a physician, at least in several years. They may see someone if they get the flu, but haven't really developed a relationship with what we term a primary care physician. And I think the campaign is really to focus on that if we can do something that will make a tremendous impact on the health and well-being of our communities, is to make sure that everyone develops a relationship with a physician, just so that they have that relationship going forward. It's as important as developing a relationship with, you know, a banker or even your local grocer. I mean, it's something that you should be doing to maintain your health.
So how does the current outreach campaign play an important role in that from your perspective as a healthcare delivery point? It sounds like in some respects that's what differentiates the current initiative from a lot of other commercials and infomercials and things we see from hospitals and health providers.
So one of our taglines really along with this campaign is people before patients. And, you know, that really means to us that we really want to involve people and want to get them involved in the healthcare before they become patients. So, that's, I think, the way the campaign really helps and really focuses us, by just making sure everyone understands that, wellness and health begins pretty much, at home, and starts out before you actually come into a physician's office with illness or with disease, because we think that many of these things can be preventable. You know, examples of that would be weight reduction or diet or exercise or smoking cessation or treatment of hypertension. You couldn't actually have a discussion about wellness if you didn't spend time talking about diabetes, and diabetes, especially type 2 diabetes, is rampant throughout the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And has devastating after effects, long-term health issues.
Yeah.
And many of the patients who come in with diabetes could have actually been prevented from having diabetes in the first place had they just had a discussion with a physician about, you know, dietary restrictions, minor ones,
that is the,
and some exercise.
I was going to say, that is the sad part. We devoted an entire segment to it 2 weeks ago, and the numbers in Connecticut are shocking and disturbing, and it's great to hear that there are other health networks and individuals like yourself and your teams at the Western Connecticut Health Network centers that are acutely working and focusing on that issue. So that being said, does the new patient engagement campaign for Western Connecticut Health Network have components targeting everyone, or are there actually does the rollout phase into certain specific demographics or groups or geographical areas in Western Connecticut where you're really trying to get the word out?
So let me pass that over to Joe, and he can speak to that.
Yeah, John, you know, I think it's important to know that this transition that we talk about from patients to consumers, because they are more engaged in their health care. People are dealing with changes in benefit plans with high deductible plans, and now they're facing choice in their households. The similar ways they buy products and services, they are also looking at health care. So that makes us look a little differently on who we're aiming after, and we certainly are providing care for every spectrum of the demographic. And our campaign will have a series of key messages, beginning with people before patients that Dr. Keller had mentioned, but will evolve. But there's clearly evidence, and certainly proven in our research too, that the primary driver driving health care, and I think many households throughout our certainly in our communities, which are Fairfield and Litchfield County, but throughout the country, are women managing the immediate health of their families and their children's, and oftentimes their husbands and perhaps elder care. So while there is a wide spectrum of messages that we will target through the various channels I mentioned earlier to reach those demographics, the primary driver of healthcare decisions in this country remain women.
So what is going to be different about what your consumers and patients are hearing and learning as they become more engaged in the Western Connecticut Health Network delivery points, Danbury, Norwalk, and New Milford hospitals, as well as at the offices of many of the physicians that are part of Dr. Keller's network? I mean, today you have, as you so aptly pointed out, consumers that have a lot more financial investment and control of where they get and how they get their health care covered. So is there a component of focus on marketing to help make people feel more comfortable that they're investing their hard-earned dollars in the right place when they turn to a Western Connecticut Healthcare Network provider?
Yeah, and I think, as I said earlier, we intentionally did not want to do any incident-based marketing or promoting of sickness. Mm-hmm. We wanted to promote life, and taking into consideration in part of our dialogue that consumers make decisions based on quality, value, and experience. And we want to express through all of our communications the exceptional care you will receive at Western Connecticut Health Network, the value we place behind that, and the experience that you will engage in where you don't feel like a number or a name on a chart. We're committed to understanding consumers' needs, both on a clinical and personal level, to tailor the care directly around them.
We are hearing a lot about this sort of almost one-on-one personal care and medical care delivery. So it sounds like Western Connecticut Health Network is really kind of promoting that.
That's correct.
So, John, I mean, it's Dr. Keller again.
Yes.
You know, the real changes, I think, in the landscape, and I alluded to them before in terms of what's different for patients and physicians, mm-hmm. is really the mobilization and the consumer-driven selection process, which in some part is being mediated through payers and a requirement for higher copays and higher deductibles. But frankly, even independent of that, consumers are much more involved in their health care knowledge and delivery, and it's a process that's been seen throughout the United States. And the old model of, I let my doctor take care of everything and I trust him completely. I mean, we still trust our doctor, but physicians now know, and patients now know, that they are much greater advocates for themselves and for what's actually happening with their own health care.
Mm.
I mean, it's truly becoming a consumer-driven industry, and up until maybe 5 or 6 years ago, it hasn't been. So I think that's different. And one of the things that I've done for the last several years within our own group is really making sure that we introduce that entire concept to our physicians so that they're aware of that.
Mm.
And they're aware that the consumer, you know, goes to Yelp and tries to find a physician from that. And gets involved with going through Google and looking for information about his physician or his disease state, and brings that information in for a discussion with a physician even before there's disease, even just saying, I want to try to stay healthy. How do I stay healthy? And starts a discussion with that. And that's very important, because that's actually, I think, the way to try to reduce the illness in the United States and the endemics that we have. I mean, you mentioned one, diabetes. Hypertension's another one. Mm-hmm. Coronary artery disease is yet another. You know, coronary disease is still the leading cause of death in the United States, and in many cases, completely preventable.
Very good. Dr. Keller, thank you for that input. I've got about 30 seconds left if Joe or you, Dr. Keller, can just let people know how they could learn more if they have not yet been touched by the new patient engagement campaign at Western Connecticut Health Network. Where do they go to learn more?
Yeah, thanks, John. I would encourage, in addition, we've launched 4 new websites for the network and our hospitals. Encourage folks to go to WCHN.org. to learn more about the benefits of what our integrated care network brings to them, and then could see the unique elements of our campaign and the humanizing healthcare tone we're trying to create, which is inclusive of some video and other senior leadership testimonials.
Excellent.
Along with patient testimonials. Sorry.
Awesome. As we pointed out at the beginning of the program, if you're hearing a lot about WCHN, it's not a new radio station, but it is a newly improved and enhanced healthcare delivery network, particularly serving Western Connecticut. It's the Western Connecticut Health Network, and we're pleased to talk a little bit about it with Joe Carafano, VP of Marketing and Communications, as well as our new acquaintance, Dr. Andy Keller, a longtime practicing cardiologist with internal medicine background. He's chief medical officer for the Western Connecticut Medical Group, the physician arm of Western Connecticut Health Network. I learned a lot today. Thank you, gentlemen, for the information. And Andrea, thank you for taking care of the interview. Thanks. Well, a lot of things are happening in April. It's a very, very busy month. It's the month that we turn our attention toward what we hope will be the eventual spring. The ground is thawing, and that means that excavators and homeowners are putting shovels in that ground to do improvement work, utility work, gardening installations, landscape construction, all kinds of stuff. And it creates an opportunity to remind you, as we always do around this time every year, that the efforts of Call Before You Dig Incorporated, or CBYD, are being backed by Governor Daniel Malloy, who proclaimed April Call Before You Dig Month here in Connecticut. April is also National Safe Digging Month, so the governor issued a proclamation reminding Connecticut residents and companies and anyone who may be listening across the nation whose states support this program that conduct excavation work using power or mechanical equipment that the state law mandates that they notify Call Before You Dig here in Connecticut by calling 811 or using several of the other means to notify the state at least 2 full working days prior to starting any work. We're welcoming back in studio a good friend here of the program. He's been with us before to remind us and talk from the front lines about the necessity to call before you dig. Tom Bashaw is here. He's the manager of field operations and engineering procurement at Iroquois, of course, the pipeline company. You can't get those pipes underground without digging. And, of course, there are always the potential of threatening those pipelines by digging. So he's a great guy to have on board. Tom, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. It's good to be back.
So it's an exciting time for Call Before You Dig, although it's kind of a niche movement. We're kind of celebrating here during Call Before You Dig month, not only in the fact that more people that need to are using Call Before You Dig services to be safe and dig safe, but we are also among, if not the nation's leader here in Connecticut for damage prevention as a result of folks using Call Before You Dig.
That's right, John. It's something we're proud of here with Call Before You Dig in Connecticut. Connecticut has one of the best records in the nation as far as damage prevention. And with that, we're consistently trying to keep on that leading edge. And one of the things we've just recently updated our website to keep it more user-friendly and comfortable for folks to go in and get information on what they can do to protect themselves and underground utilities when doing any kind of excavating.
And I was going to say, although you work for Iroquois, this is something of critical concern to all utility companies, telecom, gas, electricity, across the board.
That's right, John. The board of directors at Call Before You Dig is made up of a diverse group of utilities in Connecticut. That's telephone, communications, cable, water, sewer, gas, electric. We all sit down and we put on one common hat, and that's the protection of underground utilities and to focus on the damage prevention efforts to keep people safe and protect those utilities.
If you just joined us, Governor Malloy has proclaimed April Call Before You Dig Month. It's also National Safe Digging Month. If you're going to be digging, you need to call 811 two full days prior to starting any work or utilize some of the other cutting-edge technology that are available to both professionals and homeowners in the event they're going to be digging, not just here in April, but anytime throughout the year. We are with Tom Bashaw. He is the manager of field operations and engineering procurement at Iroquois, the pipeline organization. Now, Tom, aside from calling 811, what are some of the other ways that amateurs and professionals can get access the safety mapping that Call Before You Dig will deliver?
One of the things is, certainly folks can always call their local utility, but, probably the best thing and what we try to push is the fact that there is that website for Call Before You Dig Connecticut. We do television advertising where we have spots on TV where we promote it. And, we encourage folks to go in there because the Call Before You Dig Connecticut's website is probably the most informational posting out there.
We also, don't want to generate a lot of calls that may not be necessary. Under what situations is it safe to just, stick a shovel in the ground and do some digging? Should virtually anyone doing any digging on their property at least make the call?
Yeah, we would recommend that anybody that's doing any type of excavating. And you can kind of exclude some minor gardening when people are planting flowers, vegetable gardens, those types of things. But, we want to encourage folks to, to either dial the 811, go to the website, do the e-ticket. They have the phone apps. It's a simple call. It takes literally a minute or so. And you can ensure yourself safe digging no matter what you're doing in your yard or wherever. Because you put in that notice and any utilities that are in your property, or they'll get a hold of you, they'll come out and do the markouts. Some of the things that we try to encourage folks to do also is that not all utilities possibly buried in someone's yard could be owned by the utility company. They could be the responsibility of the property owner. Mm-hmm. And that even goes for some commercial properties. Typically with gas, the gas company will own up to the meter. But sometimes folks run gas services over to maybe heat a swimming pool or maybe to heat a heater in a garage, things like that. So we encourage folks to come to the website because we also offer private utility locators that'll come out to your property and locate anything on your property. They're experienced at it. They know how to identify things, and they can really be of some assistance to, help folks do things safely.
Okay. And I guess my final question is for the purpose of so many folks who now delegate to contractors and service providers for work on their properties, commercial or private, whose responsibility is it to ensure call before you dig is contacted. Is that an assumption that any property owner should make, that it is their contractor or their vendor who's going to make that call, or is it up to the actual property owner where the work's being done?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's actually up to the person performing the excavating. So if a homeowner has a contractor coming to, say, put in a swimming pool or whatever, the responsibility of the call before you dig ticket is of the contractor doing the work. But it's a good idea for the homeowner just to remind any contractors that are coming to do any excavating work in their property to make sure that they did call. And the homeowners can always verify by getting a ticket number from the contractor, because they'd be issued a number for that ticket.
Excellent. Every 6 minutes in the U.S., an underground utility line is damaged because someone decided to dig without first calling 811. Call Before You Dig's mission is to protect the public safety with regard to excavations near underground facilities by providing this vital communication link between excavators, public agencies, and public utilities anytime, anywhere. They now offer apps. They offer an e-ticket program. It is Call Before You Dig Month here in Connecticut. It's also National Safe Digging Month. Connecticut is proud to be the leading state in the nation for Call Before You Dig safety. We want to keep that up. We want to keep you protected. Keep your neighborhoods and communities protected. And we want to thank Tom Bashaw, Manager of Field Operations and Engineering Procurement at Iroquois, for coming in and talking to us in studio once again here during Call Before You Dig Month. Tom, thank you so much for all your resources, and best of luck out there as the ground melts and digging season begins. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Vayette. I'm John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People. Or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab at our radio station website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.